Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 9th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today he will be continuing his series on moral ecology. Today's session number is 7 and is titled Beyond Forrest Gump, The Moral Ecology of the 60s. Let's listen in.
I'm Jim Farrell, and I'm working on a series of talks and conversations about the moral ecology of everyday life. And today the title of my talk is Beyond Forrest Gump, The Moral Ecology of the 60s. Forrest Gump, as most of you know, was a 1994 film that won both critical and popular acclaim. It is a tale told by an idiot signifying something. Today, as Holden's designated idiot, I'd like to speak briefly about some of its significances and in making sense of the 60s, and I'd also like to talk about some of my own sense of the 60s. Between the movie and me, this lecture will be like a box of chocolates. You'll never know what you're going to find. Forrest Gump works by juxtaposing the story of a friendly fool with the story of American history from the 1960s on. Thanks to the magic of special effects, Forrest meets John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon. He is present for the integration of the University of Alabama, for the Vietnam War, and for episodes in the counterculture and the anti-war movement. Throughout the movie, Forrest's care and compassion, especially for Jenny, is juxtaposed with the systematic violence of the culture around him. At some level, we are asked to think that the personal is preferable to the political, in part because the political, and especially the politics of the 60s, is portrayed so negatively in the movie. Forrest Gump, therefore, reinforces the conventional 90s wisdom about the 60s. The wisdom that Newt Gingrich dispenses, for example, is that the 60s were the cultural crossroads when America turned the wrong way. Inspired by the radical left and the counterculture, the story goes, the country embraced big government, the welfare mess, the Vietnam syndrome, rock music, free love, psychedelic drugs, undisciplined education, affirmative action, multiculturalism, cultural relativism, secular humanism, feminism, homosexuality, and the devil all at once. One of the nice things about being a historian is that you get to extend the circle of your conversations because you get to talk with dead people. In the last year or so, I've been writing a book about the 60s, and I've had the opportunity to talk considerably with many people from that period. In a way, I've been sort of like Forrest Gump, going up and getting a chance to talk to people. They don't respond in quite the same way for me that they did for him, but I probably get more words out of them than he did in the sort of quick cuts that they had in the film. Like Forrest Gump, I've been able to meet the people of the past. What I discovered, however, was different than what Forrest found out, and different than the deceitful and distorted picture of the 60s that is marketed by contemporary neoconservatives. What I discovered is a movement that tried to apply the care and compassion of everyday life, the virtues of the simple Forrest Gump, to the politics of the period. What I discovered is that the images of the 60s, the assassinations, the war footage, the protests and confrontations, the radical counterculture, all make the decade seem both more and less radical than it was. In a way, they make it seem more radical because they make it seem pretty disorderly. On the other hand, they make it seem less radical because mostly what they show is people who are engaged in some forms of political protest. And that's a kind of conventional thing in American culture. I would like to suggest that the protest of the 60s was both radical and conservative, and that this, to me, is the most interesting thing about it. Indeed, because it was radically conservative, and I'll use the two terms actually now together, radically conservative. I think many people in the 1960s were radical conservatives. It was, in fact, more radical than most of us believe. That term I've taken from an article that was about Wendell Berry, the Kentucky farmer, who's a wonderful critic of American society. And somebody said, well, he's a radical conservative. And it means that the term conservative means that he wants to conserve the best traditions of the country. The word radical means that he thinks that things are so far out of whack now that you have to do something radical to preserve those traditions, that we've come so far from them. But he's still looking to maintain the spirit of those early traditions. I would also like to suggest that beneath the surface, the spirit of the 60s was essentially spiritual. I would like to suggest that when we think of the 60s, we focus not on the Marxist radicalism of the late 60s, but on the religious radicalism that preceded it and pervaded the decade. not on the newness of the New Left, but on the oldness of its religious origins, not on what Abby Hoffman called revolution for the hell of it, but on revolution for the heaven of it, not on the violent revolution that didn't happen, but on the nonviolent revolution that did. If we think about the 60s not just as a political movement, but as movements of the spirit, we will need to recover the original meaning of the word religion. In contemporary American culture, religion is to a large extent what we do on Sundays before the football games. It occurs in a specialized time of the week, definitely not prime time, administered by specialists we call religious. But at its most radical, at its root, and remember that the word radical means getting to the root, so it has in its meaning also a kind of conservative meaning. The word religion means connectedness. From the Latin verb religare, it means to bind together, and it is meant to bind people to God, people to each other, and peoples to God's creation. In the 60s, a good part of what happened is that a large group of perceptive people began to understand their connections to the rest of the world and to act as if God had something to do with it. Even those who didn't believe that God had anything to do with it often called themselves Christian atheists, as SDS's Carl Oglesby did, or saints without God, as Albert Camus said in one of his novels, and his novels were very, very popular in the 1960s. To a large extent, it was privileged young people that made the changes in the 60s, and these privileged young people learned this sense of connectedness, of spiritual connectedness, of spiritual solidarity, if you will, from several different groups of old people, including Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement, Allen Ginsberg and the Beat Movement, A.J. Musty and a group of anarcho-pacifists, sort of combination of anarchists and pacifists, clustered around Liberation Magazine, and Martin Luther King and the African American Civil Rights Movement. Together, these old people taught young people in the 60s what I would call political personalism, a set of beliefs and behavior summarized in the late 60s slogan, that the personal is political. And one of the things that I do in this book that is really fairly unusual is I try to suggest that in some ways the 50s and the 60s weren't that different. Usually the 50s get played as kind of the time of happy days when everything was just fine. People were cruising around in big cars with tail fins and stuff like that. And then the 60s are presented as this kind of very radical, very different kind of decade. But almost all the stuff that seems radical in the 60s is already there in the 1950s. And in fact, some of it goes back as early as 1933 when Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker get started. As I said, I'm writing a book on how the personal got to be political and vice versa, and the story, I can assure you, is very long and very, very complex. But I've also written an article on the Reader's Digest. I love to think up titles for things and then write articles for them, and I one time thought of a title, Making Nuclear War Digestible. And it was on, so that suggested that I should read the Reader's Digest to see what they said about nuclear war from 1945 to the present. And so I took it as my project then to read the Reader's Digest for all those years, but I actually couldn't do it. It was too much. I would have been brain dead if I'd come all the way to the present. So I stopped in 1963, but I did write an article on the Reader's Digest. So I know that anything, no matter how complex, can be condensed into just a few points. So here then is the Reader's Digest condensed book version of a book that I'm working on. I actually have the copy edited manuscript with me here at Holden. I'm sort of reading through now to see what the copy editor thinks I should change. And what I'm talking about now is this personalist politics, a term that was not real popular in the 1960s, actually more popular before the 60s, but which I think aptly describes what was going on in the 60s. And I'm going to present now some of the major ideas of this personalist politics and some of the ways that they played themselves out in the 1960s. And I think I have 8 interrelated assumptions here, but I'm not absolutely sure. And I may turn out to be like my advisor in graduate school. He used to give lectures, and he would say, there are 10 reasons for the Civil War. First, this. Second, that. And then there'd be about 45 minutes of lecture in there. And then he'd realize he was near the end. And he would say, and 10th. So this could happen in here. But anyway, I'm going to try to keep the numbers straight for you. First, as the name suggests, personalism stressed the inviolable dignity of persons, which is not the same as the rights of individuals. If people were created in God's image, other people were obligated to treat them well. That's the central idea of 60s protest. In many ways, then, the genesis of the 60s protest was the Book of Genesis. Personalism focused especially on poor and marginal persons using their condition as an index of the health and justice of society. Poor people, they thought, were a sure sign of an impoverished society. American political personalism began on May 1st, 1933, when Dorothy Day and Peter Morin established the Catholic Worker Movement. Peter Morin summarized the philosophy and practice of the movement in one of the verses that he called easy essays. He wrote these easy essays for the Catholic Worker Movement, and they're sort of verse, they're usually pretty clever. This is one that's pretty good. The Catholic Worker believes in the gentle personalism of traditional Catholicism, and here's where my sense of the conservatism of the 60s come. You know, what could be more conservative than the Catholic Church? The Catholic Worker believes in the personal obligation of looking after the needs of our brother. The Catholic Worker believes in the daily practice of the works of mercy. The Catholic Worker believes in houses of hospitality for the immediate relief of those who are in need. The Catholic Worker believes in the establishment of farming communes, where each one works according to his ability and gets according to his need. The Catholic Worker believes in creating a new society within the shell of the old, with the philosophy of the new, which is not a new philosophy, but a very old philosophy, a philosophy so old that it looks like new. Politically, as Dwight MacDonald noted in 1952, the Catholic Workers are hard to classify. They are for the poor and against the rich, so the capitalists call them communists. But they believe in private property and don't believe in class struggle, so the communists call them capitalists. And they are hostile to war and the state, so both capitalists and communists consider them crackpots. The politics of political personalism was a politics of witness, a politics of example, a politics of pastoralism, in both senses of the word, of care for other people and of getting back to the land, and a politics of personal responsibility. Personalist emphasis on the God-given dignity of individuals was the basis for the civil rights movement, the war on poverty, the campus protests, and the anti-war movement. Segregation, said Martin Luther King, who studied philosophical personalism at Boston University. In fact, that was the reason he went to Boston University for his PhD, was it was and still is the center of philosophical personalism in the United States. Segregation stands diametrically opposed to the sacredness of personality. It debased both the people who were segregated and the people who enforced segregation because it depersonalized African Americans and took away what King called their somebodiness. He used that phrase over and over again in the 50s and 60s, the somebodiness of black people, which is to say their essential personal dignity, God-given. Poverty, like racism, violated the dignity of persons because it cut them off from the resources God had created to sustain them. The Catholic Worker solution to this problem was houses of hospitality, in which people who embraced voluntary poverty fed people whose poverty was involuntary. Practicing the virtue of hospitality and the works of mercy, Catholic Workers embraced the poor as ambassadors of God, giving them a chance to serve as Jesus did. Peter Morin even thought that the houses of hospitality were as much for the rich as for the poor, because they gave the rich an opportunity to get rid of the excessive wealth which violated their standing as members of the human family. One person who worked at the Catholic Worker in the early 50s was Michael Harrington, who wrote a book on poverty called The Other America, which helped inspire the war on poverty in the early 1960s. The policy and practice of the Vietnam War was also an affront to personalist beliefs. The personalist focus on the life and dignity of individual human beings was contradicted by the wholesale slaughter of the war. And napalm and cluster bombs came to be condemned not just for their murderous efficiency, but for their impersonality. Personalists especially decried the bombing morality of the war, whereby pilots flying B-52s at 50,000 feet could indiscriminately destroy people on the ground. The weekly body count added to the degradation of personal dignity because it measured the progress of the war by the destruction of persons. Okay, that was first, the sort of a reliance on the innate and inviolable dignity of persons. Second, because political personalists assumed the essential harmony of personal and political life, they assumed that religious and household values could be applied to politics. They believed that the goodness of a Forrest Gump had social and political dimensions. As Peter Morin said, the world would be better off if people tried to become better. And people would become better if they stopped trying to become better off. For when everybody tries to become better off, nobody is better off. But when everybody tries to become better, everybody is better off. Everybody would be rich if nobody tried to become richer, and nobody would be poor if everybody tried to be poorest. And everybody would be what he ought to be if everybody tried to be what he wants the other fellow to be. Personalists believed in essentially what we would now call family values, the public practice of personal morality. The contemporary religious right believes in family values, but only apparently within the family. Care and cooperation apparently coagulate where bloodlines end. But political personalists believed in the public practice of these household values, like care and cooperation. On November 1, 1961, for example, an estimated 50,000 housewives went on strike for peace. Their reasons were perfectly personalist. As women and as mothers, they said, they were obligated to take political action. The nuclear policy of the American state had jeopardized their ability to protect their children and to prepare those children for a viable future. Because the state had interfered with their role as mothers, they would use the nuclear family to challenge the nuclear state. American women, they said, practiced care and concern, compassion and cooperation in their families. And now it was time for the men who were politicians and policymakers to practice those same virtues in the human family. Third, political personalism was suspicious of systems, including the market economy and the state, because they were not ultimately focused on the dignity of persons. Personalists were suspicious of the market economy because they did not believe in economic man, the sort of fictional, self-centered individual who feels no obligation to others, and because they abhorred the injustices that the market accepted as normal. They decried the depersonalization of people in the impersonal factories and bureaucracies of the modern economy. And that was one of the reasons why they chose the name Catholic Worker, because work was a central issue for them, and they thought that work had become demeaning in the course of the 20th century. Personalists were suspicious of the state, in part because they feared the corruptions of power, and in part because the habit of looking to the state for solutions to social problems excused individuals who could be doing something here and now. In Feeding the Poor, for example, Catholic worker Peter Morin contended that in the first century, when the poor were fed and clothed and sheltered in Christian communities, the pagans would say, "See how they love one another." But in the 20th century, when taxes took care of welfare, the pagans would say, "See how they passed the buck." Morin's ideal actually was that every home would be constructed with a room of hospitality. So every home in America would have an extra room where the poor could stay if they happened to be in the neighborhood. That was his ideal. And then he would say, essentially, you don't need to have a welfare system because it would be provided by people practicing what they preach, usually in their Christian denominations. When activists in the 60s opposed what they called the system, they often opposed bureaucracies focused not on the call of service, but on the service of efficiency. Starting in 1964, students, for example, protested the impersonalization and depersonalization of American institutions, especially the universities. One of the New Left's most tangled threads, said Jack Newfield, was the revolt against the IBM card. I actually had to explain that to students this year, because they don't know what an IBM card is. They've never seen one because we're now in the age of personal computers. But it's the revolt against the IBM card, against the urban impersonalization and the alienation of mass society. According to Theodore Rossack, this cultural disaffiliation of the 60s began with just this painfully intense experience of being a person in the world that despises our personhood, a world whose policy is to grind personhood down into rubble and then to remold the pieces into obedient, efficient, and of course, cheerful personnel. Students looking for a vocation got instead the vocationalism of higher education. The calls for academic relevance then in the late 60s were calls for nothing less than a curricular and pedagogical personalism. When students asked these two essential educational questions, when we talk about education on Thursday, I'll suggest these are the two most important questions in education, why and so what, they found that Americans' educators couldn't always give satisfactory answers for why they were doing what they were doing. In many cases, students realized that they had been taught very well by what they had not been taught, and they sought to remedy the deficiencies of their education. By the mid-60s, students began to realize that the silences of the academic curriculum were as eloquent as the expressed offerings. The fact, for example, that few colleges were prepared to teach about Vietnam seemed very important to students. The academic ignorance of the experience of African Americans and of women also seemed both conscious and unconscionable. And you have the movement in the late 60s to do third world studies, to do women's studies, to do black studies, all those things that were really generated by students who said essentially, that's part of the experience of the world. Where is it in the university? Why isn't it there? Revolting against what C. Wright Mills called the higher ignorance of specialized higher education, students demanded a curriculum that spoke to contemporary needs. They wanted their book learning connected to their experiential learning. They wanted universities that served the community in the same way as the freedom schools of the South had served the African American community. Educated by their own rebellion, they hoped to be educated for rebellion. They also demanded a pedagogy that treated them as persons, and they objected to the routines, general education requirements, majors, minors, computerized registration, courses, massive lectures, tests, units, grades, averages, honors, that reduced them to interchangeable parts in a system of competitive advantage. They also, as they got thinking about it, began to object to the paternalism of the university's policies of in loco parentis, universities acting in place of the parents. Students who saw themselves as persons had a hard time dealing with institutions that treated them like children. Curfews and visitation rules, alcohol and tobacco policies, dress and dance codes, all were part of a broader campus culture that regulated students allegedly for their own good. At Berkeley in 1964, when the protests began there, there was a 9:30 curfew for women who had to sign in and out of their dorms. Students wanted, as Mario Savio said, the freedom to be responsible. Fourth, personalists believed that changes in consciousness and changes in conscienceness could bring social change. They hoped to convert people to moral action. They hoped to make Americans more personable, not more friendly, but more able to perceive and preserve the personhood of their neighbors. If you change your mind, they thought, you change the world. Now, this usually doesn't come through very well in the images that you get of the 1960s, and it certainly doesn't come through in Forrest Gump. And one example of that is Abby Hoffman in Forrest Gump. He's depicted as this, the guy in the red, white, and blue shirt at the rally who uses only obscenities, and you get the sense that this is what the 60s was all about, and this is what Abby Hoffman was all about. The real Abby Hoffman, for example, though, unlike this foul-mouthed media image we see in Forrest Gump, believed that he could raise people's consciousness of their social responsibilities. Like many other countercultural activists, he had roots in personalist politics. As a student at Brandeis in the late 50s, he had been part of the Beat Bohemian scenes, and so he had some connections to Allen Ginsberg, the Beat movement, Jack Kerouac, people like that. In Worcester, Massachusetts, where he worked from 1960 to 66, he worked closely with a small radical Catholic community coordinated by Father Bernard Gilgan, a Catholic worker. As program director, he arranged Friday night roundtables at the Phoenix, an ecumenical meeting place that hosted speakers like Catholic workers Dorothy Day, Ammon Hennessy, War Resisters League's David McReynolds, historian Howard Zinn, and Robert Drynan. In 1965, he invited Allen Ginsberg, but he got no response. At Brandeis, too, Hoffman studied with Abraham Maslow, who and was an enthusiastic student of humanistic or existential psychology, focused on people as persons with potential for health, wholeness, and even holiness. And this is an important dimension of, and something I think I've done that's kind of original, is to link up this humanistic psychology of the 50s, which is a response to both Freudian and behaviorist psychology that suggests in a way that people are disoriented and they need to be cured, or sort of inherently disoriented and they need cures. Humanistic psychology says basically, we think probably people are healthy and what they need is to be challenged. And Hoffman really ran with that, and the whole counterculture also runs with, essentially within a framework of humanistic psychology. Humanistic psychology was a loose confederation of therapies linked by a common set of assumptions, that it was time to ask what made people healthy, not what made them sick, that it was time to recognize that treating the body was almost as important as treating the mind, and that such things as vitalizing transactions really happened. Maslow's hierarchy of needs suggested that as people fulfilled their needs for food and drink, for clothing and shelter, for love and friendship, and for self-esteem, they became capable of self-actualization, a word that gets entirely misused because in his terminology, self-actualization meant that you turned to altruism. Self-actualization meant that you turned out into community and became altruistic. Most of the time when we hear self-actualization now, we think sort of narcissistic, you know, people navel-gazing. But that's not what it meant at the time. This approach to human development offered a lever for social criticism. When society did not meet the needs of its citizens, then they might need to rebel. If society did not meet the material needs of the poor, then people should exert pressure to change society. If the conformity of social institutions repressed human development, then nonconformity could be a psychologically and socially healthy alternative. For many people, humanistic psychology became a secular counterpart of religious personalism. Hoffman, in 1965 or 66, for example, at this coffee house, gave a talk on Maslow's psychology entitled Morality for the Non-Religious. And for him, in the counterculture, humanistic psychology led not to adjustment and complacency, as 1950s psychology had done for people, but to reform of a system that depersonalized people. Fifth, he says, losing his voice, political personalists believe that people in community could govern themselves, and I want to put real strong emphasis on that, could govern themselves and their needs to reduce the conflicts caused by competitive individualism, laissez-faire capitalism, and corporate liberalism. As believers in literal self-government, they were anarchists, advocating not disorder, which is the common perception of anarchists, but less coercive and competitive forms of order. They believed that conscientious individuals could create a new world in the shell of the old. And this was a phrase they used over and over and over again in the 1960s. And what it meant was creating communitarian places that would embody the new world, a kind of prefigurative politics that would show how society could change. Holden Village might be an example of that. And I would in a way guess that in the 1960s there was some personalist politics here at Holden Village. They believed that conscientious individuals could create a new world in the shell of the old, a world in which it would be easier to be good. And again, this is a phrase that Peter Morin used. Can we shape a world with its institutions so that it would be easier to be good? Throughout the 1960s, they created what I'll call parallel institutions to serve whole persons better than the established institutions could. In the South, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee created freedom schools for African-American children victimized by segregated schools, and they created the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to challenge a Democratic Party that wouldn't let black people vote. In the North, students established free schools and free universities, and at St. Olaf, they established the Parra College in 1969, which is an alternative educational system based in some degree on sort of assumptions of humanistic psychology, to teach the relevant topics that professors wouldn't touch with a pedagogy that was both personal and professional. And the paracollege's pedagogy is entirely personal. It's a one-to-one tutorial system that we've set up. And so it fits within this framework of a personalist politics. At the end of the 60s especially, communes offered a place to practice the personalism that these people preached. They aimed at avoiding the alienations of modern life by creating supportive communities. Rejecting technological progress and materialism, they've embraced voluntary simplicity and sometimes a subsistence economy. To do this, they drew on anarchist traditions of the face-to-face community and the mystical and magical traditions of religion. They practiced what historians now call prefigurative politics by living the everyday life that they hope to achieve in the future. Sixth, personalists knew that institutions can make it easier for people to be good, and so they took political action to affect law and policy and to create structures of justice which they saw as love in action. And one example of this is the Catholic worker began to protest against the Atomic Energy Commission in the early 1950s. For first, it was just one of them, a guy named Ammon Hennessy, who decided about 1951 that he would undertake a fast on each August 6th for as many days as there were years since 1945. So it was 6 years, 6 days on in 1951, and by the time it was the 1960s, it was like 16 days that he was fasting in front of the Atomic Energy Commission. In 1955, a whole bunch of them decided, the New York State had a civil defense law that said that if there was a civil defense drill and you didn't take shelter, you could be prosecuted. And the Catholic workers just thought this was really crazy. So they got some friends of theirs in the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the War Resisters League. And in 1955, during an Operation Alert, which was sort of a great big nationwide practice for a nuclear attack on the United States, 28 of them stayed above ground in New York City's City Hall Park. And as usual, as they did with their protests, they notified the authorities and they notified the press that they were going to do this action. Ammon Hennessey even notified the FBI and added a personal note for J. Edgar Hoover, which said, "We are, as you know, subversives, though no more than always." They were arrested, but they weren't jailed because the judge didn't want to make martyrs of them. Their arrest, however, did not deter the criminals, and they made the activists made the protest an annual event. In 1956, Hennessey, Dorothy Day, and a few others refused to participate again, and they were sentenced to 5 days in jail. In 1957, they got 30 days. In 1957, when the judge told Hennessey that he should render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, Hennessey responded that most Americans rendered too damn much to Caesar and not enough to God. In 1960, Hennessey and Day were joined by 1,000 protesters singing the civil rights anthem, "We Shall Overcome," as the police ordered them to take shelter. The following year, more than 2,000 people gathered in City Hall Park. After that, there were no more drills. And in 1963, the Limited Test Ban Treaty was signed. Seventh, political personalists did not think that this revolution was optional. Instead, they saw it as an essential obligation of vocation and of citizenship. Rejecting important assumptions of liberal individualism, they thought that people are constituted in community. And this is a real important assumption of theirs. People are constituted in community. There is no such thing as a self-made man. Communities make people. And if people are constituted in community, they are morally responsible for each other. They understood vocation not just as a job, but as a call to help create the kingdom of God on earth. And they understood citizenship not just as residency in a country, but as active participation in the public good. Eighth, political personalists believed in the harmony of means and ends. The more violence, they said, the less revolution. Consequently, they tried to practice the cooperative virtues that they hoped would characterize a future society. In their own organizations, they used consensus decision-making and participatory democracy as an alternative to the emphasis on hierarchy and expertise in American government. In the wider society, political personalists generally tried to protest in ways that were consistent with a love ethic. Martin Luther King, for example, protested racism because it violated the worth of black persons, but he protested nonviolently to avoid violating the dignity of racist persons. Because people who did evil could be good, he thought, appeals to their better selves could make the world better. Nonviolent direct action was a way of living the revolution now, and it was the characteristic method of protest in the civil rights and anti-war movements of the 1960s. A fact which is entirely missing in most of the popular images of the decade, partly because violence and disorder play so much better on television, as I was suggesting the other day when I talked about TV. Now, because the 60s questioned authority, and they questioned a lot of the authorities of the 1960s, the neoconservative orthodoxy of the 90s asks us to see the 60s as a revolt against American values. But in fact, it was a revolt against some American values in the name of other American values. It challenged many ideas and institutions of Western culture in the name of other ideas and institutions of Western culture. It was not, despite all the rhetoric of both critics and activists, an un-American activity. In fact, there were many cultural continuities in 60s activism, with Democratic and Republican traditions, smaller Republican traditions, with Romantic reform and American anti-modernism, with the social gospel and Catholic social teaching, with Bohemian radicalism and the anarcho-pacifist tradition, and with some essential elements of the old left. Against the first language of American individualism, to use Robert Bellah's term, the new left spoke a second language of what I would call communitarian subjectivism. And this communitarian element of the 1960s is real important. Despite its radical image, or perhaps as a cause of it, there were conservative roots and roots of 60s radicalism. In general, I would like to suggest that the movements for social justice in the 60s were successful not because they were new, but because they were old, rooted in the rich second languages of American religion and civic obligation. People didn't move left in the 60s because of compelling analysis or the merits of Marxism. They moved left because people like Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day and A.J. Mustey appropriated the religious language of the churches, including language about the sacredness of persons, and turned it to reform. This language is almost entirely absent from Forrest Gump and from most contemporary images of the 1960s. It is almost entirely absent from contemporary political discourse. It is worth remembering and worth enacting. Personalists in the 60s renewed traditions of American radicalism, particularly religious radicalism, and they have passed those traditions on to us. Holden is, I think, a part of those traditions. This is a personalist place, rooted in the social gospel, the civil rights movement, liberation theology, liberated feminism, communitarian anarchism, and radical pacifism, and probably a few other things too. When we respond faithfully to these traditions, when we act in our everyday lives as if people mattered, we are the revolution here and now. I'll stop there. That is a very short version of what I've been doing, but it should give you some ideas of where I'm coming from in this interpretation of the 60s. And I can see I've just stunned you.
Political personalism sounds very consistent with Jesus' teaching.
Yeah, it is. It's a kind of radical Christianity, and that was what Dorothy Day and Peter Boren were trying to do. Was to, and for them, they as members of the Catholic Church, which Dorothy Day said was often a scandal to them, they were trying in a way to leap over the church to the Christianity that they really believed in, and they would get in trouble from time to time with the Archbishop in New York, but he mostly seemed to put up with them, thinking that otherwise they'd become something not Catholic, like, say, Lutheran or, you know, something like that.
Did it then seem to appeal to more people who are already part of a Christian community?
Yeah, I mean, probably the most important person in this tradition is Martin Luther King. All he does basically is say, be Christian, practice what you preach. That's part of it. He also has this civic Republican part of him. And he says, the Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal. When are you going to do something about it? And so he's really good at sort of going back to the traditions and bringing them up and saying, here are your traditions, now live up to them. And one of the cardinal crimes in the 1960s, particularly for students, was hypocrisy. You know, and what they didn't like was having learned, like I learned in civics classes, all this sort of rhetoric of democracy, and then seeing it played out in different ways. That didn't seem consistent with the rhetoric. And so a lot of what the 60s is about is saying, we believe in these ideas that you taught us. Now we'd like you to live by them. And that's why I don't think that in the 60s, there's a lot of talk about generation gap in the 60s. I don't think there is much generation gap in the 60s. I think the young people learned what the old people had taught them and then took it very, very seriously and said, this is what we believe. You taught us this. My own situation would be an example of that. I grew up Catholic. I grew up in a tradition that had, you know, lots of stuff about Jesus as peacemaker and blessed are the peacemakers and stuff like that. And my parents encouraged me to take religion very seriously. They wanted me to become a priest. And so I did. I did a lot of study of religion, and I went to all Catholic schools all the way through college. And when it came time for me to register for the draft and to do that sort of thing, I just sort of looked at my tradition. I looked at Pacem in Terris, which had come out in 1963, where Pope John the 23rd said there is a tradition of the Catholic Church that supports conscientious objection and radical pacifism. And I said, I can't join the army. Now, my father was really angry at that, because my father was a World War II veteran. And he had willingly volunteered for the army to stop Hitler, and he and I never could come to an agreement about what was going on. But I saw what I was doing as consistent with what he had taught me. It wasn't consistent with what he had done in World War II, but it was consistent with what he had taught me.
The story you tell of the 60s, the personalist side. It's very hard, I mean, something you've lived through, it's very, very hard, speaking for myself, it's very hard to be objective about it or clear about it, but my sense was that there was very definitely that,
right,
and a very strong idealism that did go back straight to what we grew up learning right in school and all along, and that America is special, America is about freedom and justice, and we're not just one more country or one more empire in a history of empires, but that there's something special here, and there's almost kind of a sacred destiny.
Right. It was a language that was used in American foreign policy, a language of American mission, mm-hmm. and it was one that I think, again, young people took seriously. That if we're going to be, the term that historians use for it is American exceptionalism, if we're going to be exceptional, if we're going to be a city on a hill, an example to the world, we have to be better than other countries.
And I feel that there's definitely that side in 60s radicalism, or 60s, or maybe radicalism is the word here, but just 60s resistance
right.
to what's going on. But on the other hand, isn't there also a strong strain that's just coming out of American individualism and resentment of any imposition of control or things on yourself? Example, I mean, if there wasn't that element in it, why is it that protests dropped, in my memory, they dropped way off, and resistance to the draft drops way off after the lottery is instituted, which effectively eliminates two-thirds, three-fourths
right.
of the young men from consideration of being drafted. So all of a sudden, everybody before had been worried about being drafted.
The kind of selfishness of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Two-thirds, three-fourths, now don't have to worry, and all of a sudden, then the protests drop way off.
I can't remember when the lottery occurred. I think it was in 1969 or 70.
Yeah,
there are some really big protests in 1970 and 71. In fact, the biggest protests of the war, the biggest anti-war protests are in those 2 years. But in general, I'd say that you're right about that. And I don't mean to say that everybody who went to a demonstration in the 1960s understood political personalism. I didn't. I mean, it wasn't a term I had ever heard until I started doing the research for it. But it seemed to me to be a way of getting together these clusters of people who people normally don't think have anything to do with the 60s, like the Catholic Worker or the Beat Movement. But I definitely agree that when I discuss the draft, for example, in the chapter on Vietnam, I talk about the ways in which the draft was an occasion for people to meditate more seriously about issues of war and peace than they would have before. And often that meant in a kind of selfish way also. There were people who were conscientious objectors. There were also people who were just draft evaders. And there were all kinds of ways that students devised in order to evade the draft. You could get your blood sugar up in ways that would keep you out. You could fast long enough that your weight was too low. I mean, there were all kinds of ways to do that. So there was a selfishness also in this.
You could go to seminary.
You could go to seminary.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, you could. I mean, early on, you could stay in school, and that was something that people did. So there were all kinds of ways in which there was a selfishness to it, and I think that's true in all reform movements. That you simply have to assume that there's going to be a selfishness blended in with the idealism that's there. There also seems to be a kind of selfishness or radical individualism that you're talking about in the counterculture, because one of the phrases that they use a lot is "do your own thing." Interestingly, though, "do your own thing" was almost always conceived within a communitarian framework. It meant do your own thing within a small group of people who are a support group for you, and in fact a community. And you didn't deviate from the, in a way, you were conforming to that community. What it meant was that community could deviate from the rules of a much wider community, of the national community. So while it looks radically individualist, it's really what I would call anarchist and communitarian at a scale that's different from what most people were used to at the time.
What happened after the 60s then?
The 70s. The
70s. People,
the
mythology is that the 60s died.
Right, the mythology is that the 60s died.
New way of
and that, it depends on what you think counts as the 60s. If you think that the 60s, if what counts as the 60s is very large protests going to Washington and things like that, it died about 1973. If you think that having whole bunches of hippies in Haight-Ashbury was the 60s, then it died probably about the same time. If you think that it was about personalism, then it was there, because communes continue into the 1970s. Food co-ops start about 1970. There are almost none of them in the 1960s, but food co-ops are a way of living the revolution now. They're what I would call a parallel institution. We have supermarkets, we have food co-ops. They embody what we think the world ought to be like. People working cooperatively, eating good food, Food co-ops were also involved in community organizing, so there was a politics of neighborhood also involved with that. And again, the scale was smaller. It was kind of a smaller anarchist scale. Harry Boyd has a book on the 70s called The Backyard Revolution, and his contention is that radicalism simply ceases to be national and becomes local. The environmental movement gets going in the 1970s, and it tends also in the 1970s to be mostly local. The Clamshell Alliance in New England and the Abalone Alliance in California are two examples of anti-nuclear movements that started in the 1970s, working from a kind of personalist politics. And many of the actors are the same in these. It's really interesting to see how the 60s activists who had been involved in, say, SDS, which collapses about 1969, many of them carry over and are doing things at the local level in the 1970s. So I would contend that there's a continuous personalist presence all through the 1970s and 1980s. And there's a real good book called Let Your Life Speak by Robert Holdsworth, which looks at the anti-nuclear movement in the 1980s when people were alarmed by what Reagan was doing with nuclear weapons, and finds that at the local level it has these kinds of communal properties to it and a very strong Christian element to it as well. In fact, he uses in that book the term personalism to describe what he found when he did a case study of Richmond, Virginia, that it was really a much broader thing than the anti-nuclear movement. It was a cultural protest that used the anti-nuclear movement as its main focus. And that would be something that would make my book really fairly different. Almost everybody else sort of quits with the 60s, at least by, I mean, you pick some event like Altamont or Kent State or the fall of Vietnam in 1973 or something like that, and you say that was the end of the 60s. But I think if you're looking at at sort of a set of values like this and a set of practices too, you can find them continuously.
What about the 90s?
I think they're still there in the 90s as well. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on locally, and if you just sit around and talk to people here at Holden, you find out about a lot of it. You know, people who have been to a hunger conference, people who are working for Citizens for a Healthy Bay in the Seattle area, people in Portland who are involved in a kind of land use planning that will make the city more ecologically viable. All of that seems to me to be consistent with a kind of personalism. After about 1967, the Christian and religious dimension of it, I think, gets downplayed. I don't think people are as vocal about their religious commitments as they had been early on. Martin Luther King, when he dies in 1968, I think that tradition, to some extent, it's minimized a lot. Jesse Jackson continues it, I think. But he's nowhere near as influential as Martin Luther King was in his time. And anyway, I think what people like, the reason we have a national holiday for Martin Luther King is that people like that personalism. They don't know the name for it, but that is, I think, essentially what they like about King. A person who will take those traditions and use them, I think, wisely, and also practice what he preached. You have a question here? No.
It's been a long time since I studied history, but you're talking about how important these things were and the carryover into the 70s, 80s, 90s. Would you say that this is another great awakening for our country? Would you?
The 60s?
Yeah. I mean, we have a history of revivalism. Do you see that fitting in?
I wouldn't have to say that because William McLaughlin did that. He has a book called either Great Awakenings or Revivals and Reform or something like that. And he says the 60s are the fourth Great Awakening.
Do you agree with him?
Yeah, I think in a way. I mean, it certainly is a religious revival. There are two books called, one called The Restructuring of American Religion and another one called The 60s Spiritual Awakening, both of which also make essentially that kind of claim. And a lot of, the churches are really changed quite a lot by the 60s, usually not in the 60s. Usually the churches are, on the whole, behind the curve on stuff like this. But that the churches should pay attention to liberation theology is to pay attention to something that essentially Martin Luther King is doing liberation theology before it goes to Latin America. That's what he's doing in the late 1950s, and the churches begin to pay attention to that. The churches, this article here by Robert McAfee Brown, he was involved in citizens or clergy and laity concerned about Vietnam, which started in 1966, was a way of getting the mainstream Protestant denominations together to protest the war. And that anti-war stance, I think, has carried over to, I mean, the churches aren't entirely anti-war, but it means that by the 1980s, when the Reagan administration is acting very militarist and really depending a lot on their nuclear arsenal, almost all of the mainstream churches have statements about nuclear weapons that are consistent with a personalist ethic. Interestingly enough, the Catholic one, which is issued in 1983, and is probably the most famous of them, explicitly acknowledges Dorothy Day and her personalism as an influence on the church in the development of its social ethic from the 1950s to the 1980s. Because in the 1950s, that ethic was not accepted by the church. The church believed in the just war tradition at that time, as did most of the denominations.
If I could pursue McLaughlin just
sure.
a little bit, doesn't he talk about, does he see a little bit of a pattern in our history?
Yeah, he sees a cycle pattern, and Arthur Schlesinger also sees one. And they would suggest that in the 1990s we ought to see another revival, that it's about every 30 years that you see some sort of either reform or revival.
I wondered what your learned opinion would be on that.
Mine would be, it's kind of a nice thought, but I wouldn't buy it.
Okay.
I believe, too. As I said early on in these sessions about a week ago, one of the concepts that historians use most is contingency, which means that at any time anything can happen. And so it would seem too predictable to me to think that things work in 30-year cycles. I think that any time anything can happen. We may have a radical revival in the 1990s, but we may not. And a lot of it depends on what people like us do.
I like to think I'm a real optimist, but I was in a group of people within the last 2 weeks. And I wish I could say I'd done something about it, but I heard the most racist talk I've heard in my life. Things like, if you see a black man riding a bicycle, don't hit it because it might maybe your bicycle. And it made me feel very discouraged about Martin Luther King, our country. What good has happened, really? I think you could rev up feelings for an unjust war if you wanted to. At the present time, I think we could wave the flag and it would take off.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't think that the 60s won. I think the 60s are an influence that's still important, but I don't think the dominant institutions have changed dramatically. Although, it depends where you look. I think higher education has changed dramatically because of the 1960s. It's really quite different than it was then. I don't think the national government is drastically different than it was in the 1960s. I think that explicitly fewer people are racist than were at the time. But I think there is a kind of backlash now occurring in race relations as we move against affirmative action and things like that.
The story you tell is basically American, the way you tell.
Yeah.
This is my own ignorance here, what's behind Dorothy Day. Are there strong European predecessor movements or parallel movements or?
I don't know the answer to that fully, but I know that, in, especially with Dorothy Day, that there are movements of personalism in France is actually the most prominent one in the 1930s. There's a journal published called L'Esprit, edited by a man named Emmanuel Mounier. And he actually publishes something called a Personalist Manifesto. Peter Morin was the first person to get it published in English. And that comes out of predecessor French movements at the turn of the century called the Sillon and one other one that involved worker priests and taking the gospel into the gutter kinds of things, what in America would be called a social gospel kind of thing. And Morin was very much influenced by that French tradition and brought it into the Catholic Worker and Dorothy Day. Day was more influenced by, she'd grown up I think she was Episcopalian to begin with, and then fell away from religion entirely, became a socialist at University of Illinois in the teens, wrote for many radical magazines during World War I, kind of bummed around during the early 1960s, and then had a conversion experience. Actually, conversion experiences are common among the people who end up being the really dominant personalists. Dorothy Day had one, Martin Luther King had one, A.J. Mustey had one, Thomas Merton had one. The leaders, at least, seem to have these conversion experiences that shift them often from secular left-wing stuff into religious radicalism. And that would have been true for Day and for Merton and for A.J. Mustey.
I guess what I was saying is I've stood in groups and sung We Shall Overcome, but I'm not sure anymore.
That we will?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's students sometimes ask me that too. You know, what do you think, Mr. Farrell? Are things getting better or worse? And I always make for them the distinction between optimism and hope. Optimism would be the sort of empirical sense that I think that things are getting better, which at this particular time I don't think they are. But I won't be a pessimist because hope is something else. Hope is really something that comes out of one's Christianity, I think. And I think that we're called to hope whether or not we're optimistic. And that means that I sort of keep working at things as if, which is a phrase that they like to use in the 1960s too. You act as if, Dorothy Day said she wanted to act as if the truth were true.
George Anderson, the new president of our church body, spoke at our last church convention, and I love what he said. He said, we can get discouraged if we take our eyes off the star that we're following. And that's hope.
Yeah.
And we start living in the realm, unless it happens now, we're gonna give up. He said, you gotta keep following the star. And I like the way he put it. I don't know how to put it the way he put it, but it was really hopeful.
Yeah, and I think a lot of 60s people gave up. They said essentially, we've been at this for a long time, by the mid 70s, and not much has happened. And we're out of the war, but we don't think that the government did it because they believe in anything personalist or pacifist. We think they just got beat. And so we don't think that anything substantial has changed. So a lot of them got very disillusioned. There's a real famous exchange of letters in the 60s from a young radical named James Forrest, who was in the Catholic Worker Movement and the Catholic Peace Fellowship. And he wrote a letter to Thomas Merton saying, in 1966, we've been protesting this war for about 5 years now, because the Catholic workers had started protesting it before anybody else even knew what was going on. And nothing's happening. The war keeps getting bigger and bigger. And 66 was when the escalation was really big. And I'm really disillusioned, and I'm getting burnt out and all this sort of thing. And Merton wrote back and said, essentially, you have to separate yourself from what Americans might call the fetishism of results. It's not your job to get results. And in fact, McAfee Brown says that in this article here. It's not your job to get results. It's not your job to be successful. It's only your job to be faithful. That's all you're called to do, is to be faithful to what you see and to keep at that. But that's your job. You need to do that. Especially that's your vocation. We might look real quickly at a couple of things on here. I'll tell you some of my favorite ones on here. I'm just giving you 13 lessons from the 1960s. I really like number one, and that's the one where he says, remember that results can almost never be measured. And there I think he means that you may have affected somebody in a way that you don't know and won't come out until much later. Now, I find this in my teaching. You know, I'm teaching away, I do a class, people pass, they go on. 5 years later, I get a letter from somebody saying, I finally read that book that was required for that class, and it's really changed my life. Now I'm going to do this. You know, I didn't know that was happening. I'm always hoping that I have some influence, but you don't know, and you don't know exactly what the influence will be either. Sometimes you can have influences that you don't know. As, for example, one of my students got to working for Target stores and decided from his work in American Studies with me that culturally the time was right to bring back the G.I. Joe doll. So he was responsible for bringing back the G.I. Joe doll, and he wrote me a letter saying, you're responsible for it because you taught me this cultural analysis that would teach me how to know what was right at the time. And he sent me one of the new G.I. Joe dolls, which I have in my office. These were ones now that were not against a communist enemy, but against an Arab enemy. I use it in the American Studies Museum as a as one of the artifacts in the American Studies Museum to say how we teach children really about American militarism. In the second column, I really like number three, although you must keep some priorities about what is important. Remember that almost all issues centering on social change are interconnected. And at the bottom of that, the quotation from Anthony Lucas, America's dirty little secret is class. Hardly anybody talks about class in America because we all think we're middle class, but in fact, class is there. It's very important. And I think my all-time favorite in this list is number seven. You are called upon to be who you are, where you are, not to be somebody else somewhere else. I find that, especially for my students, they think, God, we're not going to be activists like you were in the 1960s or like people were in the 1960s. Therefore, we can't do anything. And the important thing is to say, here you are. You're here. You do what you can do where you are and not try to be somebody else, not try to imitate the 1960s because that would be dumb. It's the 1990s now, and there are other things that need to be done. I also like the last one. I guess it turns out to be 15. Don't try to go it alone. You need to be in community. And so all sorts of communities are important. We're at the appointed time to quit and move on and mill around for 15 minutes until dinner starts, but if people want to hang around and talk, I'd be happy to do that too. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Yeah.